With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
We've got David Lennon on the line from Newsday. For those listening on the network not familiar, Newsday is a Long Island newspaper, been in business for a long, long time. Kornheiser worked there, Peter King. David Lennon has been there for a long, long time and is a great, great baseball writer. And David joins us on the CBS Sports Radio Network now. David, how you doing?
Great, Richard. Thank you for that intro. You put me in some illustrious company there.
Well, you wrote a column today, and a friend of mine who lives on the island hipped me to it, and you know, I was reading it, and it's great. And it's about somebody that I think probably 90% of the listening audience has never heard of now. In New York, probably they have, but a fellow by the name of Jay Horowitz. And Jay Horowitz, for years, was the PR director of the New York Mets. And Jay is such a lovable guy. You relate how the 1986 world champion Mets, PR guys, you know, I don't know what they were making back then, but it wasn't a lot of money. But they voted him a full World Series share, which was something like, what, $93,000, which at the time was a lot of money, much more than he was making in his salary, right?
Yeah, well, to put it in perspective, Richard, I mean, I think Davey Johnson's first managing contract with the Mets was probably less than $100,000. So that gives you an idea. Yeah, that was a pretty significant boost. So when you get for a PR guy to get a full playoff share voted by the players, I mean, that's pretty remarkable. I mean, sometimes if they're very lucky, they'll maybe get some sort of percentage share, but even that's rare. So the fact that those players, you know, a legendary group of Mets, a legendary group of New York athletes, you know, voted Jay a full share that year was, I think that gave you an idea of what Jay brought to the table for them.
Yeah, well, I've got a bunch of Jay Horowitz stories, but one of them was, you remember Sid Fernandez, the lefty, you know, from Hawaii.
Sure.
And this was 1987, and I was down at Met Camp with my buddy Rick Cerrone, and we were doing interviews, and we were in the Mets hotel, and Jay said, look, guys, you know, really love the way you guys do interviews, and Sid is very shy, and Sid, you know, just is not real good at interviews, but I've been coaching him up, and Sid really wants to come on your show, and he's going to be really good. I promise you, he's gotten so much better. Can you put Sid on? So we said, "Wow, geez, after an intro like that, why not?" So he said, "And ask him about," and I think I may have this wrong, but he eats pancakes before his starts. Really? And he goes, "Yeah, he makes these pancakes, and they're really good. And it's like, you know, Wade Boggs with chicken. He eats pancakes before every start, homemade pancakes that he makes. Ask him about that. He'll love that." So we go, okay. So we start the interview, and Sid is kind of not into it, stumbling a little bit. So finally we said, okay, well, let's put him at ease. Hey, Sid, tell us about those pancakes you make before every start. I don't make pancakes. Sid, you know, we have it from a good source that before every start you have these very special pancakes. And he goes, I don't know who told you that. I don't do that. And Rick and
sounds
I are both
like,
Jay, like,
sounds like Jay set you up.
Well, I was going to say if it was anybody but Jay, I would say he set me up. But, you know, at the end of the interview, we said, Jay, what are you talking about? And he said, I don't know why he did that. He told me that story yesterday, and I said, yeah, we'll get it on the air. And, you know, he just denied it, said it never, never happened. So
now
was Jay being a straight man, and he really did set us up then, you think?
No. I mean, I think there were times that Jay did like to have pranks, but that was more around April Fool's Day. One of the things about Jay that he always kind of did, even from his days back, as the SID for Fairleigh Dickinson College, he would always look for the off the beaten path type of angle, you know, to talk to somebody about, whether it was a player or a manager or a coach. So the fact that he did come up with the pancake thing actually doesn't surprise me. I couldn't tell if that was a situation where he was playing a joke on you or that was real. And it was probably real because knowing Jay, he probably was trying to come up with an angle to give you guys, and for whatever reason, Sid didn't feel like playing along that day, I guess.
Yeah. Well, after that, I mean, Sid, it's one of those things where, you know, if you do a live interview, and you've probably done this where, you know, you're talking to somebody, and at the end of the interview on the radio, you say, okay, we're going to send it back to New York and back to the studio, and we'll be back with blah, blah, blah. Sid, the second we say, thanks, Sid, rips the headphones off and walks off. I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, what did we do to offend him? And maybe it was he didn't want the pancake story to be out there, and we put it out there. But the next day, we were interviewing somebody else, and we were sitting at this sectional in the hotel lobby, and there was this big glass table at the sectional where we set up our tape recorders and things like that. So yeah. Jay walks in, and I forget the Met that he had with him. And the first thing Jay does is he sits on the glass table, and it shatters into a million pieces. And Jay is lying on the ground going, what did I do? And there's glass all over the place, and the hotel manager comes out, what are you doing? You're breaking our table. And, you know, but just the look on Jay's face when that table collapsed under him was priceless.
Yeah, there's a lot of those type of stories, too, for sure.
No, it says in the book, and I haven't seen the book yet, but that he whiffed on the Keith Hernandez picking him up after he was traded to the Mets. What happened there?
Yeah, he wanted to, make an impression, and he showed up in a white limousine to pick up Keith Hernandez at the airport after the trade from St. Louis and Montreal, and missed him, couldn't find him, and Keith just wound up taking a cab to get to the stadium to play that day, so... Because Jay wanted to do that because, you know, Keith wasn't happy about the trade, you know, being sent to the Mets at the time. And Keith also said that he hated playing in Montreal. So he was going to be in a terrible mood when he showed up anyway. Jay thought he could maybe soften the blow a little bit by making a big impression on him. And then it just whiffed on him trying to find him at the airport. So yeah, there's a bunch of, whether it's, you know, spilling a glass of orange juice on Frank Cashin on his, you know, interview for the Mets job. There's a lot of mishaps along the way, and yet Jay still survived 40 plus years in with the Mets. So that's a pretty big accomplishment.
Yeah, it sure is. And, interesting during this whole virus thing, a lot of reporters are writing stories about the past and about yesteryear. And that 1986 Met team, at the time, the fans, I mean, we didn't know. I was basically a fan back then in 86. I didn't know much about the team, in terms of internally, other than they played hard. And I remember the Ray Knight fight at third base. And, you know, they were our tough competitors. And as we're finding out now more and more, they weren't such great guys in a lot of ways. There was a story that one of your colleagues, Joel Sherman, wrote about how they treated Greg Jeffries when he first came to the team. This was a couple of years later. And that was a real disgrace the way they acted and the way he acted back then.
Yeah, I did. I saw the story that Joel wrote. He did an excellent job on that. I think with that 86 crowd, and I mean, they were just real hardcore, old school, you know, crusty baseball types, you know, hard living, hard drinking, hard smoking, whatever else you want to add to it. You know, that's kind of the way they lived. And they kind of wore those emotions on their sleeves. And they talked to the media. And if they had things to air out against teammates or anybody else, they said it. You know, they just kind of let it fly. And, you know, because that was before my time in the business covering stuff here. I was still in college then, but knowing those guys even now, you know, I know them now that they've mellowed, you know, a little bit in their older ages now as broadcasters and whatever else they've got on to. But, you know, I kind of miss that part, Richard, right? You know, that was when sports was, you know, the guys didn't fear, you know, the social media backlash or that type of stuff. They just kind of said and sort of did what they wanted and fought guys on the field and had opinions about stuff. And looking back now, you know, they certainly weren't the most PC bunch. And, you know, if you look at that stories and how they treated Greg Jeffries, I mean, that wasn't, you know, that was much different than what you would see in this day and age too. So, yeah, they were just a throwback crew. And I think that just kind of adds to their legend. Yeah, they weren't angels. They weren't perfect by any stretch. But man, they cemented, you know, their place in New York sports history for more than just winning that championship. I mean, they for what they accomplished on and off the field during that times, I mean, it's in my mind, you know, that really kind of fits the mold of what you would call a legendary team.
Yeah, and back then, and this goes before your time as well, but I started doing sports, I guess, in about 1970, and I was on a little station on Long Island, and they were so accessible then because I would, you know, we had a 6 o'clock sportscast or newscast with a sports thing, and I had a minute and a half to do sports. I would call Shea Stadium and ask for Gil Hodges, and they would put me through. And they would put me through to Gil Hodges' office, and Hodges would take 5 minutes with me on the phone, 10 minutes with me on the phone, just taping an interview. I mean, I could dial the stadium and ask for the manager, and they put me through right away. Now, imagine that today.
I know, right? I mean, listen, you know, the business of sports has grown exponentially, you know, in ways that I won't say nobody, maybe some of the smarter visionaries could have seen it, but certainly most people didn't expect it to grow into what it's become today. And it's still sports, but the business side of it and the exposure and kind of the glamour part of it and all that has really, you know.
Have we lost David? Have we lost the internet? I'm not really sure what's going on there. We seem to be off. David, are you there?
I'm here. I can hear you.
Okay. Why don't we take a break now? And we'll be right back when we clear up our technical issues right here on the CBS Sports Radio. All righty, we are back. One of the hazards of working from all over the country now instead of one's central studios that we're very dependent on our radio lines being solid. And sometimes when there are thunderstorms and rain and all kinds of nasty weather, we get knocked off for a little bit. And it was really strange because I was talking to David Lennon and he wasn't there. And yet, in the studio in New York, he was there and I just couldn't hear him. So something must have happened on my end. Anyway, we're talking with Newsday's David Lennon, talking a bit of, nostalgia about, the way sports have, changed in terms of the coverage. And, David, today, are there any, I mean, we know LeBron James takes stands politically and will say things. Are there any baseball players like that you can go to and get an honest opinion? Whether you print it or not is up to you, whether you think it's relevant to the story. But are there guys who will be, you know, more candid with you than other than, well, played real hard, you know, teammates are great. Anybody that gives you more than cliches these days?
Well, it's like on like political subjects or just kind of things.
Or
in
anything, you know, yeah. Sociologically, political,
yeah,
what's going on.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, you know, a bunch of these guys and some of the ones that I know better than others. Yeah, we have conversations about all kinds of stuff. You know, a lot of it doesn't appear in the newspaper. You know, they don't want to be quoted on a lot of those type of things. I mean, if things do come up, you know, if there'll be some kind of national controversy or some kind of national event, you know, not political in nature per se, yeah. But something that, you know, they've asked their opinion on, you know, they'll give it. But, you know, it's a dangerous game. I mean, as we know, you know, they just showed The Last Dance. And Michael Jordan was famous for saying that Republicans buy sneakers too. So it's, you know, I'm not sure these guys take it quite to that extreme, and I know Jordan took a lot of flack for that. But, I mean, these guys, you know, they're careful because, you know, they have a lot more exposure now. Not that the big stars didn't back in the day, but, you know, they hear about it a lot more. I mean, they have social media accounts. You know, they have people coming after them on social media. So they tend to be more reserved. I mean, I think as much exposure as athletes have now on Twitter and Instagram and wherever else they might appear, you know, a lot of times it's actually kind of made them more reserved. You know, I mean, they'll try to get maybe they'll put out little playful things on the social media things or make a couple sentence comments on those. But then in person or with the media, much more guarded than they've ever been. And, you know, I think they're just more wary of that just because of the, you know, the age we're in right now.
Yeah, that is true. And, you know, it used to be, you know, you'd get somebody on the air and they'd say something. Well, I never listen to the radio there. I never read those columns. I never read what you write in the papers. And I go, yeah, right. You don't. But you seem to know everything we say. And I think in the papers, it's, well, if they don't read it, there's a well-meaning friend that goes, hey, you know, David Lennon in Newsday trashed you today. I can't believe what he said about you. So even if the guy that you're talking about didn't read it, somebody did and told him about it. So they're very, very aware, even without social media, what's being said about them, both positive and negative, I think.
Oh, for sure. I mean, back when I started before, you know, I was starting in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s, and you know, that was before, you know, the internet was cranked up and all that. And you would go into clubhouses and, you know, all the papers, you know, were laid out right on all the clubhouse tables. So all the guys read it back then. I mean, that was the only way you got information, you know, was to actually read the newspaper or listen to the radio or watch TV. But, you know, now, you know, everybody has access to everything whenever they need it. And as much as guys may say that, oh, I don't really pay attention to that stuff, which some still do, you know, they actually do pay attention to it because they'll have Twitter accounts or whatever, and people will make comments or people will bring it to their attention. So, you know, it's they're almost better off now trying to tune things out more so than back in the day, just because now it's so difficult. Actually, it's not difficult. It's impossible to tune things out now. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you actually could block a lot of that stuff out if you wanted to.
When they come back, if they come back, baseball is talking about not having fans, at least in the beginning. How do you think that will affect the players? I read another column about Daryl Strawberry, who said the biggest mistake I ever made was going to L.A. as a free agent, because in New York, fans, if they were, you know, you're coming out from your right field position and they say you stink, I took that to heart and I go, yeah, I did. I better do better. And it was impetus for me to play better. Whereas in LA, everything was kind of laid back. They got there late. They left early. And he said there wasn't that passion that there was in New York, and that affected my play. Do you think that will happen if we come back and there are no fans in the seats?
I do. I mean, I think even me personally, I think I underestimated that part of it, because I was like, you know, it's fine. You know, sports will come back. They just won't have fans in, so we can reduce the risk that way, and they can still play the games. I mean, the important thing is to get them on TV, right? I mean, the TV networks pay for these games. They want the programming. You know, the Major League Baseball has to deliver these games. So as long as they can get the product on TV, you know, they can deal with the rest of that stuff. But then, you know, the other parts to it, when you watch some of these old games on TV and you see people in the stands, like 50,000 people, you know, at a baseball game or 80,000 at a football game, and we just kind of took that for granted. You know, we didn't even think twice about that. Now when you look at it on TV, you're like, wow, there was a time where people actually sat elbow to elbow with each other, screaming over the course of a game, doing God knows, you know, what, spilling beer on each other, whatever. And now are you going to go into like a sterile environment where it's everybody is, you know, the players are going to be able to hear people in the other dugout. You know, it's going to be like Babe Ruth games. It's going to be like high school games. not having people in the stands. And there's a lot of adrenaline involved with that. I mean, the players are human beings. I mean, they get to feel the adrenaline of the crowd noise and kind of the excitement of everything. And to a degree, I actually think that helps them because it kind of lets them, you know, get in the moment, in that one moment. And when they don't have that part of it, all of a sudden I can see their mind like, wait a minute, this doesn't feel right. You know, this feels weird. And I wonder if that's going to take some really kind of, I don't know if mental discipline is the right word for it, but just in some way recognize the difference and try to zone that part out and still perform at an extremely high level. I think there is an element to that.
And I also wonder, like, I've got the golf on now, and there's no gallery, obviously. And I'm seeing a lot of sprayed shots from the pros that I don't think I would normally see in a regular tournament. And I'm wondering, I mean, this is an exhibition, but I'm wondering if baseball players without fans there almost look at it as a simulated game, as a practice. I mean, they know it counts, of course, and they know their stats and all of that. But I wonder if mentally they're sort of like, yeah, is this really real? And maybe they're not playing at that high level because of that.
I think so, 100%. I mean, as much as, you know, guys can say how difficult it is to play in, you know, opposing arenas or road stadiums because the crowds get on them or, you know, screaming stuff at them, like you mentioned with Strawberry. That helps them, I think, get on their game. You know, I mean, that gives them the edge. I mean, at home, you know, when the fans are behind them, that kind of gets the adrenaline going. Or if they're on the road and all the fans are on them, you know, they want to kind of quiet the place. So that does add an element to professional sports in all of them. I don't care what sport you're talking about. And I think if all of a sudden everything is empty around you and there's no noise and you don't really feel that buzz, yeah, I think there's an emptiness to it that can, you know, dull you a little bit, that can kind of take away that sharpness. And like you said, with these guys playing this afternoon, you know, two of the guys are certainly out of their element, and Peyton and Brady. But, you know, the other two guys, yeah, I mean, a lot of what they do is that laser focus when they have galleries all around them. And I think that is something that the athletes are definitely going to need to get used to. And I wonder, like you mentioned, is the caliber of play going to be affected? You know, I know we shouldn't be greedy. You know, if we get live sports back, that'll be incredible and something that we've been waiting for. But I do wonder if you'll notice a difference in the caliber of play.
Yeah, and this season, if it comes off, is going to be an anomaly no matter what, because even if they're able to play 82 games, and I think that's a legitimate test. You know, it's not the 162, but it's legitimate. But you're going to have 30-man rosters, maybe 20-man taxi squads. You're going to have the DH in both leagues probably. The schedules are going to be, you know, you're going to play your own division and you're going to play the corresponding American League team, National League team in the same time zone. So things are going to be very, very skewed no matter how they try to make it look like a normal season.
Yeah, I mean, baseball players, and I know this just from experience because I've covered, you know, this sport for a very long time, and you know, the season is so long and it has such a rhythm to it and it has such a routine to it that's how these guys operate. You know, they know when they go to Philadelphia where they're staying, you know, what time they have to show up for batting practice, what time they have to do this, what time they have to do that. Everything is regimented. They can look at the schedule a long time ahead, know when they're going to be in, you know, Boston or San Diego or wherever. Now everything is going to be kind of thrown together and it's going to be condensed and it's going to take people out of that routine. You know, what they used to do to get ready or what they used to do to mentally prepare is going to be different, and not just the schedule. I mean, we're even talking about the protocols when you show up at the stadium as far as being tested for things, about what you can and can't do, how close you can stand next to your teammates. A lot of stuff is going to be different, and I think that's going to take some adjustment. You know, baseball players, like I said, they're used to doing the same things every day over and over and over again a certain way. Now you're kind of tossing that up, And I'm not saying they can't adjust to it, but that is going to take some adaptation on their part to kind of just to find their groove a little bit and find a way to operate in these in this kind of new world for them.
And the idea that they're going to put them in a bubble, essentially, and that they're going to stay at the hotel, they're not going to be allowed to go out and have late dinners and parties or whatever. You're talking about guys in their 20s, young guys who, you know, want to get out and do things. And even though they're told, hey, you can't do that, it's dangerous and all of that, you got to believe that, that guys are going to try to do some things that they shouldn't be doing, right?
Well, I mean, there is a behavioral aspect to that, Richard. I mean, and I've talked to a couple of infectious disease doctors about baseball's protocol and that sort of thing. And they say, you know, there are things you can do as far as testing and screening and quarantining and that, but it's really hard to control somebody's behavior. You know, in that 67-page manual, MLB does spell out at one point in a paragraph and tries to stress that everybody has to be told that if one person messes up, the consequences can be dire. You know, not only your own health, you're talking about your teammates' health, you're talking about other personnel's health, you're talking about blowing up the season if there's an outbreak. So, and what baseball's trying to do, Richard, traveling around, I mean, going to Florida and Arizona for spring training, then coming back north and having a travel schedule, I mean, that's much different than what the NBA and the NHL is trying to do. So the level of difficulty for baseball is going to be hard. There's going to be a lot of moving pieces here, a lot of potential for exposure. So they're going to have to really it's going to be a difficult task for them. And when you throw the behavioral part onto it, like you mentioned, too, that's another wild card that can be tough. I mean, that's an X factor that you really can't that is beyond your control. You're really going to have to rely on people making good decisions.
Yeah. Now, we hear that Major League Baseball is going to present a plan to the players as soon as Tuesday. And you just wonder, I mean, things like if a player says, hey, look, you know what? I'm not comfortable doing this. I've got a child at home who has immune deficiency disease or something. I can't, you know, expose myself to this kind of risk for the sake of my child, my wife, my mother, whatever. What happens then? Do they just say, well, you know, okay, you don't have to play, you don't get paid. You know, there's this whole thing. Plus, what if one team gets infected and the whole team has to be quarantined and they can't play? So what do? Throw the schedule out the window, every team that's supposed to play that team? There's so many complications that could happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think what they're trying to do with the expanded rosters, you know, maybe 30 active at one point and then 20 more players as kind of a taxi squad. They're trying to keep a lot of people in reserve in case somebody does get sick, and they're hoping that they can just isolate that person and just take that person out of the mix, test everybody else, and make sure to guard against an outbreak, because if there's an outbreak, you know, that takes away an entire team, and in essence, I have to think the domino effect is the season's over. I mean, once you have a team that you lose for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, then that's it. I mean, the rest of the league just can't function without the Mets or the Yankees or whoever you want to name. It just falls apart at that point. That's why they have to be so vigilant on that outbreak front. And it's difficult to do. I mean, what they're trying to do is rapid testing if something like that happens. But these other leagues that we've seen, you know, in South Korea and in Taiwan, they don't have to do daily testing or these stringent testing policies, because the public at large, they've kind of reined it in. You know, they've reined in the virus, so it's not a huge threat to the public at large. So they don't have to worry about baseball being victimized as much by it. They're only at risk as much as everybody else. So they take temperatures, they do screening, but as long as everybody seems okay, they'll just keep going on with it. Baseball and these other sports, you know, we don't really have it contained here in the U.S. right now. I know we're reopening up a lot and we're loosening restrictions, which is great. But, you know, I don't think anybody can say that it's certainly in our rearview mirror. And I think that's what the challenge is here. I think it's still very much a part of our daily lives here. And I think that's going to be very difficult for pro sports to guard against.
Yeah, and it will be part of our lives for a long, long time. I mean, even when You know, I don't know that we'll ever get the all clear signal, but we'll get the signal that, hey, you can, you know, see other people again. I think a lot of people are going to say, do I really want to go to a ball game and risk that when I can watch it on TV? Do I really want to go to that concert? Do I really want to have that kind of contact? And it's very divided. You know, there are people now who are out there partying and on the boardwalks with no masks on and close to other people. And then there are people who are just like, hey, still not leaving home. David, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us. Great insights. Always a pleasure. And let's talk again soon.
I hope so, Richard, and be safe.
Okay, you too.
Vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.